You're about to hear a preview of Partially Examined Life supporter exclusive content. To learn how to get the whole thing, check out partiallyexaminedlife.com/support. But I do want to hear about your ongoing journey. I was very happy to, A, to, you know, have done my part in editing, listening carefully, writing the summary of your Lincoln et al. Discussion, but also fine that I wasn't on there. But I did want to ask you more about the Steven Pinker. So I had read my first Steven Pinker when we did our Tomasello. There's a 1994 book, The Language Instinct. And I thought it was fine. But my overall impression, sort of in secondhand or what little of interviews I've heard with him, and, you know, he's another guy that Sam Harris seems to like a lot, is that he's sort of in the scientistic class, you know, seems like very much a sort of a lightweight as far as philosophers would take him. And you guys had very little to say about him, but I was hoping that you would have given me more information so that I wouldn't have to read him. But like, you really just kind of brushed him aside in two sentences. Did you have any more notes that you wanted to, any more points from him that you wanted to explain to me and the people?
Well, the reason I grabbed the Pinker was I literally was talking about this topic of kind of cultural confluence of science and liberal democracy and their relationship with my dad. And he said, well, what you're saying is exactly what is in Pinker's book. And so I picked it up and I read the first chapter, and putting aside lightweight or not lightweight, his summary and extolling the power and virtues of the Enlightenment, they did align with what I was interested in talking about and interested in having us engage with, about the importance of our institutions and the importance of, I'm getting tired of the word norms because it feels like it's been like deflated and we need a new word for the ways in which we do things that aren't our laws. But Pinker does, I think, lean, you called it scientism. He is very quantitative for sure. But I think in the end, that's basically a virtue on his part. I think that his advantage and his, maybe there you'd make a criticism of him, that he's a cheerleader for progress, right? He's a cheerleader for the fact that science and liberal democracy and the things associated with that have actually made the world better in quantitative ways for more people. And if you put it this way, would you really want to go back in time and live 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago? And I think the answer is basically no. I mean, that's what he would say. He would say, no, you don't want to do that, especially if you just have to randomly pick where you're going to be. It's more violent, more dangerous, less ability to flourish in your life quantitatively, less ability to heal from illnesses. And the beginning of that book that we read is a very, very quick kind of summary of that. But the reason that I gravitated towards the Fukuyama was the Fukuyama is more philosophically and politically engaged, political philosophy engaged, than what the Pinker is. Seth, you were very annoyed about the Pinker, so you should say something.
Yes, I imagine the way that he's describing it, your pessimism versus his optimism.
Yeah, well, I'm sure Pinker has done other work that isn't like this. I mean, but if you think Irigaray was hand-wavy, Pinker's just as bad. You know, it's like one of those things where you get the history of the Western world in three pages, you know, so it's like, and then there was the Enlightenment, you know, and then there was this, and then there was that. So, you know, he falls in that class, just as Dylan described, of it's the Bill Gates, you know, kind of mantra. It's like, you know, the world is qualitatively a better place now than it was 200 years ago. Or 300 years ago. Or
okay. He would say quantitatively.
Sorry, did I say qualitative? Quantitatively.
Well, probably both, yes. But yeah.
Right. So you said, Dylan, he's a champion of progress. Okay, well, what does that mean? What does progress mean here? What is this quantitative?
And it's like, it means fewer people die.
Fewer people dying.
Among other things.
Among other things. But I think the one thing that I didn't see here and that I often don't see in these types of is there's this assumption that the values that they hold dear are correct. And this is less an argument in favor of those values and more a, but come on, don't you see? Isn't it obvious? Right? So my what I want to see is somebody who says like, listen, this is my definition
sure.
of progress. This is my definition of the good. And then I can say, okay, so if the good is less people dying, great. Then how about the First and Second World Wars? So your good is less people dying of malaria.
No, no, it's not just that, right? I mean, in fact, those are bumps in his graph, right? World War II and World War... No, seriously. But it'll also be less violence in the sense of you're less likely to die a violent death. One of the shoals that this whole thing breaks on is that is the same one, like, well, it might only be 5% chance of me dying of cancer, but if I'm in that 5%, what do I give a rat's ass that it's 95% chance that I don't get cancer? I got cancer, right?
Yeah. Well, no, I think that's fair. And I wouldn't make that kind of argument. I just like, for me, I feel like oftentimes I see people speaking that way. As I said, I'm not clear exactly on what their definition of the good is or progress is. And then I'd rather have a discussion about that and say, okay.
Sure.
Because ultimately there are trade-offs, right? There are things mm-hmm. that the Enlightenment clearly responsible for in the evolution of human society that we might consider to be progressive, but it could also be interpreted otherwise. That being said, you know, the other piece is what you said is, you know, he's a scientist. His views of philosophy or his philosophical views are semi-naive, but he's well-intentioned.
Sure.
But then you get to, okay, so what's the political upshot? And it's like, you know, because he's basically making a plea for government and policies that support this continued progression, right? Like, so we want whatever that happens to be, obviously without any probably clear sense of what it takes to implement that. But the fact that he sees like democracy as progressive, and I guess other forms, communism, totalitarianism, whatever you want to say, as kind of like anti-progressive. And yet evidentially those things still exist side by side. Like there's clearly this thought that democracy, liberal democracy, was somehow progressing globally and that liberal democracy is the handmaiden of, I guess, progress. But that was just clearly empirically mistaken. Right.
Well, no, I don't think that that's true. I think it just depends upon. No. I mean, this is why Fukuyama's book is more powerful in this respect. You're right. I think that Pinker is effectively being kind of naive, and there's a way of which, can't you just see, guys? You know, I agree with you about that, and that there's a stronger defense. And that's why Fukuyama's book is sort of necessary there, is he mm-hmm. recognizes the challenge that the current time is presenting, and that liberal democracy needs to have a defense made of it in the face of claims of authoritarianism or other kinds of or fascism as better ways of having government, right? I mean, you know, I grew up, you know, at a time just thinking that, well, fascism is just a pejorative, right? But if you go back and look, right, you know, in Italy, right, being a fascist, that was like being a Democrat or a Republican, mm-hmm. right? It's like, I'm a fascist. I'm for strength. I am a partisan of the ruling power of strength. That's what mm-hmm. fascism means.
We need to reclaim that term, fascism. It's okay to apply it to our party now. That it's not just those bad guys in World War II. We can be good fascists.
Well, it's definitely going to come, Mark. That's what's happening with respect to Nazism and white power. That's what's happening right now. Is being an explicit white racist is being normalized. Absolutely, right? It's not just, oh, we need to make room for those crazy Nazis to go and have their parade. It's that, well, there's going to be a explicit racist white power candidate who's going to run for office and going to get traction. 100% going to happen.
And the irony will be it won't be in the South.
And it won't be in the South.
Yeah. It'll be in like rural Oregon or something like that. Yeah. So, and this is why I appreciated Fukuyama's earlier book as opposed to this one, though, is...
Or the identity one?
The identity one, because I think he's saying that liberal democracy needs defense. I'm not sure that's true. Like, and what I mean by that is not that it's not important to defend the things that liberal democracy is ostensibly supposed to accomplish. But as a system, it's failing. And it's failing in multiple places where its implementation is different. Like, there are many reasons why liberal democracy is failing or has failed, whichever you want to see it, in the United States, much having to do with our bizarre and screwed up two-party electoral college indirect representational system. Other countries that could be classified as democracies do not have the same kind of system are also struggling, although it seems somewhat less so.
If that sounds like the kind of thing that you want to hear more about, then please go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/support. Thanks for listening.